Good evening. This is KBIA. The program is Thinking Out Loud. Veterans Day is tomorrow. It's the day established by our United States Congress in 1954 as a commemoration of the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. Back in 1919, World War I ended. For my entire life, the World War I vets were the old soldiers, with those who served in WW2 not far behind. It's been coming for a while, but the time is now upon us when most of our World War II vets have passed away. To have served in World War II, you'd have to be around 85, and that's on the young side. Those who served in the Vietnam War era are now our senior veterans. Mark Bolton uses oral histories with these veterans in his research. Bolton is a history professor at Fulton's Westminster College. He recently gathered stories from John Betts and Terry Neeson, the mid-Missourians who served during the Vietnam era. In the next half hour, we hear reflections from Vietnam-era veterans. And a warning, the program does contain some graphic descriptions of warfare. Thanks for tuning in tonight to Thinking Out Loud on KBIA.
My name is Mark Bolton. I'm a professor of history at Westminster College. Yeah, most of my teaching and research interests revolve around the Cold War and the Vietnam era specifically. And I've written a book recently about the experience of the Vietnam veterans and the GI Bill, how they came back and kind of how they were treated in terms of legislation and the funds to help them go back to school. And so that's an ongoing thing. I've got several other projects, but I keep coming back to the Vietnam era because it is just endlessly fascinating to me in terms of the personal stories and the issues that were raised. Oral histories when it comes to wartime experiences are essential because we're dealing with individuals, men and women, who are asked to do absolutely extraordinary things. They've gone through training, which completely strips them away from civilian life. They're asked to do the most awesome and awful things in the truest sense of the word. And so for us on the outside looking in to try and in some way understand what they went through then, talking to them and getting their experiences down is essential. We get some stories from John and Terry, which may not be the typical heroic tales that we often associate with soldiers coming back from war. They are clearly burdened by a lot of what they've seen and done. We see elements of guilt. We see elements of horror in some respects of what they've experienced. And so I think that many listeners and probably some veterans listening to this as well might be a little bit startled by some of the revelations, some of the things which are said in there. Because it's not your standard, wonderful, glowing stories about experiences and adventures. This is war, in some respects, at its most brutal, in terms of what they've seen, what they've done, and the way that it's changed them.
Next up is an excerpt from Westminster College history professor Mark Bolton's oral history recording with Terry Neeson. Neeson grew up in part in Marceline. He came to Columbia in 1965 to attend the University of Missouri. When he completed his graduate degree in English in June of 1970, Terry Neeson was drafted into the U.S. Army and did his training at Fort Leonard Wood.
Came here to go to school at the university in 1965, graduated with a bachelor's in 69, and then the story begins. I was one of the last people drafted before the lottery came in. I was inducted into the Army in June of 1970, drafted out of graduate school. I was chief computer of a fire direction control outfit for a 105 artillery battery, and went basic at Fort Leonard Wood, AIT at Fort Sill, and served in the northern segment of South Korea, near the DMZ. I was exposed, coming down here to school, I was exposed to a lot of new and wonderful things. And, you know, there'd been anti-war protests, big ones, that I'd read about, that I'd seen on television, but I'd never, and caused me to question things, but not deeply. So there I am, I'm a month away from going in, being drafted, and I thought, wow, you know. So I applied for conscientious objectorship. And I went home to the interview for the Linn County Selective Service Board. And it was a very short interview. They said, are you a Quaker? And I said, no, sir. They said, then you're not a conscientious objector, so bye-bye, you know. I went, okay. And, you know, that was pretty much it. So I thought, well, you know, I'm an American. You know, I don't believe in war, but I don't have any choice. I've got to go. The Army was pretty traumatic for me. I wasn't a conscientious objector. I came to realize that later. You know, if it came down to it, I could kill and do it, maybe not with a clear conscience. I don't think anybody can ever do that. But I could do it if I had to do it. So I got over that part of it. But I haunted the chaplains at Fort Leonard Wood. And I was over there as often as I could get there, trying to find an explanation, trying to find a rationalization even that I could live with. Never did find it, but...
Do you remember how those conversations went?
Do what you're told. Follow orders. You know, don't think about thou shalt not kill. Just don't worry about it. This is an exceptional circumstance. God will forgive you. You know, and how they knew that, I'm not sure. But they claimed to be the authority. So I said, okay. And just went about going crazy on the inside.
Did you ever have any considerations of fleeing and just not showing
no.
up?
No, I never seriously considered it. Before I got my orders to go to Korea, I was home on leave in Marceline, and Dad was a Blue Dog Democrat. You know, he was basically in favor of the war. If the government's there, then it's okay. But I came home on leave before I got my orders, and he said, I don't know how to say this, but if you want to go to Canada, he said, I'll buy you an airplane ticket. And that was just not Dad, you know. I cried. I said, Dad, I don't want to go, but I gotta. If they send me there, I gotta go. And that was, you know, kind of telling. You know, it was war's okay until it's your kid, you know, and then it becomes real personal, and then you start asking questions. But I never did know. I never considered it at all, really.
This is KBIA, and the program is Thinking Out Loud. You're listening to a pair of oral histories from Vietnam-era veterans this week on the program. Here's more from Terry Neeson. He recently told Westminster College history professor Mark Bolton about his service, which mainly happened in South Korea near the demilitarized zone during the Vietnam War.
There was one little box on the back of one of the forms that said, is there any reason that you think you should not be drafted or inducted into the military? And I just said, I do not know if I could actually kill somebody, even if my life or my buddy's life depended on it. And that got me an interview with a shrink. I just explained my position. And I don't know whether that kept me out of Vietnam or not. I've often wondered that. And of course, there's no way to ever find out, no way to ever know, but that little burst of honesty. So Sergeant Smith said, the odds are you guys are going to go to Vietnam. And he said, I don't want any one of you to die. I don't want any one of you to get shot. So I'm going to make your life hell here. When you come out of here, you're going to be tough. You know, you're going to know how to obey, follow orders, and you're going to be strong. And he put us through the mill. I don't know anyone who went to Vietnam who came back unscarred. It was a Sunday. We were some of us were goofing around and on free time, but we did something that we weren't supposed to do, some minor infraction, and he caught us. It was a very hot day. No physical training was scheduled. But he made about 20 of us put, do you know what a low crawl pit is? Basically, you get down on your belly in the dirt and crawl as low as you can, you know, on elbows and knees with your butt down so you don't get it shot, you know, and you crawl fast through this pit of sand. And you go fast, and it's great exercise. It's not easy to do. And it's not fun ever. It was a hot day would have been late June. And the canvas, there was a tarp over the sand, and he didn't pull the tarp back. All of us came out with blisters on our forearms, you know. But he was just, he was out of control, just lost his temper. He was freaking, you know. And his eyes were just crazy, you know. And we didn't argue with him. We didn't do any, you know, we did it. And then he saw what he'd done. And the man started crying. And he said, "I am so sorry," you know. And we said, "Sarge, hey, relax, kick, you know. This is okay." He said, "No, we got to go to the dispensary and get you guys fixed up." And none of us were hurt bad. We had some blisters and some burns, you know. And it needed to be treated. Well, he got in trouble for it, you know. But it was weird because it just made us so devoted and dedicated to him, because we saw that he was really trying to look out for us, and he was a wounded unit. You know, he was a damaged human being, and it was because of Vietnam. And that just really drove things home for us. Because the joke was in fire direction control, you know, we're the quote, brains, end quote, of the artillery. We're the communication arm. We got antennas. Antennas are targets. So, you know, the life expectancy of somebody in AIT and of somebody in fire direction control in Vietnam was, you had a high turnover. I got orders to report to Fort Lewis, Washington, and then to the Republic of Korea. And to say I was relieved is an understatement. But that begins kind of the nitty-gritty of my experience during my military service and after my military service regarding Vietnam is survivor guilt. I got orders for Korea. Not good duty. Not good duty at all. Not easy duty. Easy duty was to stay stateside or go to Germany or, you know. But, you know, and also I think my little comment, maybe it during my induction got me dirty duty anyway, which is kind of what Korea was full of, as far as non-coms and officers go, according to the scuttlebutt, was full of screw-ups. You know, people that were being punished for whatever, or, you know, people who were out of favor. In some respects, my experience in the Army, the whole Vietnam era, really screwed me up. Even though I wasn't fighting, you know, it changed my entire lifestyle. It changed my notions about my country, about war, about everything, you know. And I don't regret one moment of it, you know. And I think the military made me a much better human being. It showed me what discipline and life and death are about. You know, I regret that time period happened. I think that was the end of the innocence, you know, for the United States as a whole. Not only did no one who survived Vietnam come back unchanged, no American remained unchanged. We learned that our government regularly tells us bald-faced lies, that our government cannot be trusted, that you've got to supervise, you got to be a hawk, you got to pay attention. Blind trust is blind.
Next up on KBIA, we hear from John Betts. He sat down lately with Mark Bolton. Bolton is the Westminster College history professor who uses oral histories in his research. John Betts trained for the Army at Fort Leonard Wood. After his stateside training, Betts was sent to the front in Vietnam.
Except for my time in the Army, I've went to school here and spent my entire life here. I had to go to New York City to get my wife, but other than that, most of my life and everything I've done has been located right here in central Missouri. Right.
Were you drafted or did you enlist?
I was drafted. I was proudly drafted.
When the draft call came through, what did you know about Vietnam and what was your initial kind of reaction?
Nothing. I'd heard the term. Of course, it was in the news by then. I think I was probably, I'm comparing myself with probably majority of the young people I was with in Vietnam, pretty typical. I had heard the term Vietnam. I'd seen it on a map, but essentially I knew nothing about it. I think I was kind of numb. I don't know what I was expecting. I think I was 18, either 18 or 19. But I don't know how I was reacting. There was kind of a numb feeling, like I don't know what's going on. Like I was so naive, and I was so naive and adolescent. It was like some sort of accident had happened, or some event over which I had no control, and I didn't know what was happening. I just really couldn't believe it was actually happening this time.
We're listening to oral histories recently collected by Mark Bolton. Bolton, a Westminster College history professor, recently visited the KBIA studios. He talked here to Columbia native John Betts. Betts saw armed conflict during his time in Vietnam. Some of these battles were large scale, but most were smaller engagements with the Viet Cong. Here, Betts describes a battle in October 1967, his final month of service in the conflict. Second warning, there's some graphic content coming up of life in wartime. That's in this next segment of Thinking Out Loud on KBIA.
So your job is just to try and locate the enemy, try and draw them out then?
Takes a while to figure out what was really going on with the infantrymen. Duh. They walk, and then somebody shoots them. Mm-hmm. And then they call in airstrikes, the jets, all the rest of it. Right. Yeah, they were just using you as pretty much the guinea pig or just to draw the fire. But that 3 weeks, my introduction, was particularly horrible because of that rain. It's the worst thing I've ever experienced. Yeah.
And did you encounter much hostility during that first 3 weeks?
Well, for 3 weeks, we basically were just doing this walking. And then they started having trouble supplying us because of the rain. And then there was no food, so we had some hunger. The third week, we're going up the side of this monstrous mountain. And I'd been thinking it for several days, I'm going to do something. I can't do this. It's impossible. There's nothing that can happen in my life that's any worse than this. And 10 minutes later, first fight, I was in. Bam, 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 bam. Monstrous fight. And shot three or four of the guys up at the very beginning. Killed a bunch of guys. A bunch of us were wounded. A bunch of people were wounded. I was lying on my stomach in this. It was just like mud. We were trying to, of course, there was climbing the hills. These hills, it was like we were grabbing on it. You grab onto things and, you know, you'd have your boots pulled off. It was so muddy. And then I'm lying down in the midst of this, all of this growth, whatever it was, and I'm looking up about 10 feet ahead of me, this new friend I had, this guy I had kind of made friends with that was from down in Texas. And for some reason, he's kind of looking around at me. With all this firing is going on, he's kind of looking around at me. And then I saw the half of his head go, bam, missing. Got hit in the head, and then just like the whole side of his face disappeared. And then I started crawling. Everyone was crawling. I remember crawling down the side of this monstrous hill, got down below and then got off on the other hill. But my friend, he was still alive, and he was screaming for somebody to come and help him, save him. And it just went on and on and on, and then he finally died. And then they disappeared.
That's how the situation would typically end, then. Yeah, they would just kind of withdraw on them.
Yeah, and then we had the dead. And then we had all these wounded guys, and then we started going opposite direction, the same direction we came, and we're packing these bodies and still had this horrible rain. So that was my introduction.
I mean, I don't know if there's an easy answer to this. How do you cope with something like that? I mean, what happens at that point?
You're an animal. Well, at a certain point, you just hard. Everyone knows it. What happens to doctors, young doctors, when they go in and they do those dissections at first, and after a while, none of it really particularly upsets you in the same way it did the first time. Yeah, you just start hardening, and it's business as usual when you start seeing it.
After an engagement like that, then do you head back to the base, or are you expected to kind of?
Oh no! No, 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 no. They, It took forever. We were packing all these dead people and then the wounded people, and they just finally went back to an area where the rest of the company was and got some food, came in. But it was an interesting introduction because the rain in particular, it's the thing that stands out in my mind is making everything. One of the most horrible moments I'd ever had was just that. It was just beyond belief being in that rain for all those weeks. There had been a typhoon, actually. It was over, and we were over near. This was when we were over near the My Lai area. And the night before had been this monstrous. And then everybody was, in the morning, once again, just miserable. And everybody was pulling off their clothes, and the sun came out. And then they sent my squad down, a click or so away from the rest of the company, rest of the company area. And we ran into, on the side of a hill, we ran into three or four NVA that were like coming off a hill and fired some shots and they went running off. And then called our company commander and a West Pointer. He'd been with us. I got to be fair now that I'm older. He was pretty good. I think he was good. He knew what he was doing, but he was hardcore. And they called the company commander and he said, "Hold on, don't go up the hill." He says, we're getting some reports or some activity in this area. Let us get there and we'll have to take the whole company up this hill. And we started, my squad, my rest of my platoon showed up and we started walking up my area. And about 15, 20 minutes up, one of the people up ahead got shot in the lungs. And we were dragging him back down and then by this time, the rest of the company's showing up, and they were just all on a line. We start moving up this hill. We start moving this pretty good-sized hill. We get to the top of the hill, and then it's cleared off. By the way, this is on 1st Battalion, 35th Infantry, the Cacti. Listeners can go to that, Cacti, 35th Infantry, 1st Battalion, 35th Infantry. You can go to the website. They got a long story about this battle on that website. But we get near the top. And all of a sudden, these areas are cleared out, and there's like this little city, huts. And everything looks new. So this wasn't the regular Vietnamese. This is something the NVA had been building. Some of our people, I didn't see it, but there were reports. So later on, some of the guys said, man, there were people in there, there were Vietnamese in there that were wearing suits like business. And they think possibly there was some kind of a meeting or something going on. There was something big going on there. But there were less than 100. By this time, our company was pretty well depleted. Our companies were always under strength, always under strength. I'll bet we never had more than about 20 people in our platoon. Should have been more like 40, 35 or 40. So there were less than 100 of us in our company. So we walk up into this area, and what there were, they believe that there may have been two or three companies of NVA. Maybe it was a battalion or whatever their version, regiment or whatever they call it. But there was maybe 300, 400 North Vietnamese. And so what they did, they came around, tried to circle us. Ferocious fight that went on during the daylight hours. Big fight. And then it got dark. And then the rest of the night, well, of course, we started getting split up in these little groups, so like one person, two person, three people. So all night long, you could hear that, everywhere you go. One of my friends that I, on Facebook, we're always sending notes back and forth. He said, "All I know is they were everywhere. and all night long that was going on. They would find somebody, and you could hear that, bow, 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 big one. In the morning, they were gone."
Incredible.
In addition to what would possibly be called, I guess, legitimate fighting, yes, I saw war crimes all the time. They went on all the time. And I know there are people now that try to say this is all exaggerated. Oh, there was just as much discipline in Vietnam as every other war. I think the truth is probably in every other war, including the Great Crusade during the 1940s, similar things were going on too. And just something you didn't talk about in those days, but I guarantee you war crimes happen all the time. I was involved in the beheading of a human being, of a North Vietnamese. I didn't do it, but some psychopaths from a recon outfit came into a village after we'd had a small firefight, and one Vietnamese that was killed, the recon people pulled him down and chopped off his head. They got in a big argument about him, and then somebody said he's particularly tall, and then another one said he's not tall. One of them pulled out a corn knife, cut off his head, stuck it on a post in the middle of the village, and then recon left, and our lieutenant said, bury the butt, go up in the woods, bury the body, bury the head, because if they find a GI, the next one they find, they're going to do the same thing. And so I got to carry, along with a friend of mine from Texas, we got the detail of grabbing him by the head and carrying his head up there. This is my experience. That's Vietnam. That's actually the incident more than the battles, the fights. That I think when I think about Vietnam and what it means to me, that's the one I remember. There's something wrong here. There's something here that ain't right.
Was there much interaction with the Vietnamese villagers or Vietnamese civilians?
Oh, not where I was. You'd go into a village and there was nothing there except elderly women and little children. Little children. There were obviously there weren't even elderly men. I will tell you, you start wondering after a while, I don't understand, why isn't everyone here? I mean, I saw the newsreels of the GIs pulling into Paris, and I said, we ain't getting that kind of introduction. And you would get looks. Now, the kids would be, we had kids that would used to climb coconut trees, and they'd get coconuts for us. But I remember the elderly women in particular, the way they looked at us. There was one woman in particular I'll never forget. At the very first time I went into a village, it was the way she was looking at it, and it wasn't with love. And I'm not understanding this. You start, if you're smart, you start picking up on there's something here that ain't right.
In his post-military era, Columbia veteran John Betts got involved with and is now the director of the Mid-Missouri Chapter of Veterans for Peace.
You probably get a lot of pushback from other veterans, I'd imagine, having that perspective.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
For years, they didn't want my group to be in the annual Memorial Day parade here in Columbia. By the way, now, I mean, they're just fine. They're perfectly courteous. And, you know, I think we demonstrated to them, we're not trying to insult other veterans and, you know, and make a mockery of the parade. We want them to see they're, you know, people with a different point of view. I've run into that before. And my own, some of my friends that I was in the second platoon with in Vietnam, I guess you could say, you can look at their Facebook postings now, they're just like World War II veterans, you know. Man, we served our country when we were called and other people ran. Those people, though, they got the right to think anything they want. I don't agree with them, but they can think whatever they want. But I really got a thing about people who weren't like my friends in the second platoon preaching to me about the morality of, well, we had to do it. No. You obviously have not read a single history book. Yeah. No, I want. I think that's what veterans can do. That's what I can do as a veteran. It's the right time and the right place, I talk to the other person. Do not thank me for my service. You got the wrong person. I ain't proud of it at all.
Thanks to Vietnam-era veterans John Betts and Terry Neeson for sharing their stories, and thanks to Mark Bolton for asking the questions. Tomorrow is Veterans Day 2015. We're back with a new episode of Thinking Out Loud next week on KBIA. For the show's executive producer and Deadhead poster child, Darren Helwig, my name is Trevor Harris. Thanks for listening.